Hello, and welcome to episode 42 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Nick Zoutra. On today's podcast, I am pleased to welcome Dr. Sabina Leonelli, Professor of Philosophy and History of Science at the University of Exeter. Sabina serves as the co-director of the Exeter Center for the Study of the Life Sciences, where she leads the Data Studies research strand. Her research spans the fields of history and philosophy of biology, science and technology studies, and general philosophy of science, and currently focuses on the philosophy, history, and sociology of data-intensive sciences, especially the research processes, scientific outputs, and social embedding of open science, open data, and big data, and the epistemology and history of the use of organisms as research models. Sabina and I have a wonderful conversation. I very much enjoyed our discussions of understanding in science amongst a number of other really interesting topics and features of her research. Unfortunately, there are a few slight internet disconnections throughout where you might hear a few patchy spots, but rest assured, the majority of this interview is very much intact, very much listenable, and I do hope you very much enjoy. Thus, without further ado, let's bring in Sabina. Dr. Sabina Leonelli, welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this afternoon?
Very well. Thank you very much, Nick.
Thank you. So how's your month of June getting on? What have you been up to?
I am visiting currently at the University of Ghent in Belgium.
Oh.
So it's a very nice time because I can actually talk to colleagues here that I don't normally see and colleagues in the continent, in continental parts of Europe. And also I'm focusing on writing in a way that I don't usually manage to do when I'm in my own institution, as you can imagine.
Sure, sure. Is this your first time in Ghent or is this kind of a frequent visit?
No, I've been a few times, okay. But I've never lived here and that makes a big difference. It's a beautiful town.
Yeah, yeah. How's it been so far being in Belgium?
Oh, it's great. I mean, my husband is Belgium anyhow, so I...
Oh, wow, okay.
You know, the country.
that's convenient.
So it's a very nice thing to be in. And I have to say, I really usually appreciate countries where people can speak three languages as a matter of course.
That yeah.
Is, you know, a big plus of being in continental Europe, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so I know there's an upcoming conference in Ghent, is that correct? The SPSP, yeah. The Society for Philosophy of Science and Practice, is that something you're gearing up for as well?
Yeah, of course. So I'm actually have multiple roles in this one edition because I'm still part of the organizing committee. I've been now for almost 10 years. And I'm also one of the keynote speakers.
Ooh,
and
nice.
I'm part of the local organizing team because, of course, I'm based in the University of Ghent just for this term. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a very nice event.
Great, great. All right. Well, Sabina, let's start back at the beginning. I'd like to hear a little bit about your story, how you got into philosophy of science, and then we'll take it to where you're going now. So, Sabina, where did you grow up?
So I grew up between Italy and Greece because my mother is Greek. And my father is from Modena, which is a city near Bologna in the center north of Italy. And that's really mostly where I grew up, really this city. That's where I did most of my schooling. And I didn't really know what philosophy of science was in any way when I was going through that training. But I guess one of the things that I was always interested in throughout my schooling years were both philosophy and the humanities in general, kind of literature, but especially philosophy. And the sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And I could never quite shake the fact that I couldn't choose between the arts and the sciences. And thankfully, at that point in Italy, it wasn't really necessary to do that. In fact, I attended a very strange high school that was at a section that was called experimental section, which had both most of the scientific subjects and all of the more classical training, including Latin, history, and philosophy. So that meant that you had to be examined in about 14 different subjects at the end, but it was a brilliant formation for me. I was very, very lucky to get that education for free
in
Italy. And that basically meant that when I was looking around for university degrees, I was looking for something that, again, would let me not choose between the two. But in the Italian context, at that point, it looked impossible to me. So I was actually, I mean, if I stayed in Italy, I would have done something like physics. In fact, I wouldn't have stayed into the humanities. But at the same time, I sort of randomly applied for abroad, particularly in the end. One of the degrees I applied for was the STS, the Science and Technology Studies degree in UCL, University College London, and I just happened to get in. And that was an incredibly lucky and serendipitous opportunity I was given. And after being exposed to that department, I never looked back.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah. So it sounds like right off the bat, I mean, in high school, you even found your way into philosophy of science, which is, I would say, unlike a lot of the guests we've had on this podcast. So that's pretty exciting. Did you think, were there some experiences in this experimental high school that were particularly telling or particularly pushing you toward that? Or I don't know, like what was it about wanting to do both that was exciting to you?
Oh, well, I'm a spoiled omnivore. I find it very, very difficult to give up completely one whole branch edge in favor of another.
Yeah.
So you can call it indecisiveness. I mean, there's lots of very negative things to think about.
Well, we can find a positive value toward it too. It's like, yeah, well, but I understand.
That's really where it came from. And I always had a strong interest in the history of the Renaissance and the scientific revolution and the makeup of the individuals that seemed to be part of those moments in history that were clearly firmly steeped in both sides of knowledge. And so that for me, I mean, these were sort of my intellectual heroes as I was growing up. And so I never quite renounced the idea that eventually I could maybe do something that would have involved both things. Though, I mean, to be honest, I never really thought I would end up being an academic.
Really?
I had an interest in music. I was in theater. I always had strong political interest also. So I thought maybe I would end up working in an NGO or something of the kind. So it wasn't, you know, in fact, I ended up pretty much being on a straight academic path.
Without
really having the expectation that would happen, if it makes sense.
I'm always fascinated by others. I mean, we all have varied interests and, different paths we could take. What were some, so you said music, theater, was that something you were involved in high school, or I imagine, or early life?
No, I studied music since I was very, very young. Mm-hmm. So I started my first piano lessons when I was 3 or 4. And I quite heavily, actually. I was in the conservatory for many years in Italy. And so for me, that was a big part of my childhood, studying music. I think it gave me the focus.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's for sure.
I imagine, do you still play? Do you still practice?
Not nearly as much as I would love to.
Not like a conservatory level or something like that, yeah.
No, absolutely not. I've lost that completely. That was just a maintain. But you know, I mean, partly when I can, I still play, and I make sure that my children learn some music. At this stage, I think I'm putting much more effort into educating them than keeping up my own education. But it's still certainly part of my life, yes.
Okay. All right. So going into – all right. Well, so getting into UCL, was the idea of academia – you know, was you went on to study these things, but was – I guess what did you want to do at that point? What were you thinking?
Well, I mean, my expectation was that, I mean, of course, I was interested in potentially the academic path.
Sure.
But I knew it was very, very difficult to get into. And so probably the thing that I most looked at was either a career in science itself, so thinking about going off to do research for maybe different agencies or doing research for NGOs and kind of social movements or politically aligned institutions. Because I've always had actually quite a strong involvement in activism of different types, politically speaking, especially in that period of my life. Mm-hmm. And so I imagine that because some of those issues were things that studying history and philosophy of science really prepared me for, thinking critically about the role of knowledge in society, then that might have been a field that I would have naturally fallen into because of my training.
Great. Yeah, so how do you think... your maybe perhaps training in HPS and STS kinds of studies could prepare you to do work in an NGO, a non-government organization?
Well, I mean, for instance, at the time in which I was studying, one of the big issues was the use or not use of genetically modified organisms in Europe. That was one of the issues. And of course, that was deeply relating to the issue of basically post-colonial exploitation and monocultures in different parts of the world, and what people would do in Europe about that, and how companies based in the States and in the Europe would actually control a lot of the ways in which other parts of the world farm. So that was clearly a situation where knowing about the history of the biological sciences and about science in particular, but in fact any branch of science, and the relationship between different centers of power in Europe and what was happening in the rest of the world, particularly during the scientific revolution and the years after that and during the 19th century, had a clear bearing on thinking historically about how do we then get to a situation in the 21st century where we have very specific arrangements for how knowledge is discovered and produced and who benefits from that.
Oh, we might have lost you for it.
See, the relationship was very strong. And in fact, I was part of in UCL was also extremely good at really making these books explicit. So several of the lecturers that, I mean, you know, there was a very good foundation in philosophy of science, in history of science, and in sociology of science in right, but they were also very, very good at making sure that students would see the interrelations between these subjects. So I certainly absorb that a lot. In fact, that's what I sort of keep doing in my work right now.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is great. Yeah, so what was your time like at UCL undergrad? What were you up to?
Well, I mean, mostly studying at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
because, you know, I mean, I just arrived from Italy. I never really used English outside of an academic, of a school context. And even then, I actually picked it up relatively late because my first language in school was always French. So for me, the first year in London, a lot of it was a big learning curve in terms of learning what it means to study in English. Writing essays was a completely different type of thing.
Yeah.
Because the structure of thinking in an essay is very, very different and the expectations are very different. So that was a big big issue. Yeah. And of course, just getting to know the international atmosphere in UCL, making lots of friends that were from different countries and comparing experiences. So, yeah, I mean, it was pretty intense time, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, sure. I met
a restaurant at that point, so I really did have a very full schedule.
What did you do? You said you worked at a restaurant or something?
Well, I mean, just to support myself.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Hard to see me being in London, but, I mean, that always needed a top-up.
Yeah.
So there was that too. Yeah.
Cool, great.
But I mean, at that point, you know, it's still the case, actually, that the STS department in UCL is a relatively small department, but they devote incredible amounts of attention to their students. So I really benefited from that. And at that point, for instance, Azok Chang was part of the department still. And for a year, one of my mentors, what I did. So I had several people, Brian Balmer, Joe Kane, that really helped me at that point find my way through the system.
Great, great. So, yeah, so you did you studied at UCL and then... it seems like, what happened next? What were you considering then? And once you did your STS studies, was this at the point where academia seemed, that path seemed to be more solidified, or what were?
I found my studies extraordinarily interesting, and I really fell in love with the subject, and in fact, the way in which they were doing it in UCL at that point. Mm-hmm. And so I did look for a PhD. Straight off the bat, thinking that actually that would be something I would love to be able to do, no matter where it would lead me. Mm-hmm. And at that point, there weren't that many places really in Europe that would offer a PhD program in philosophy of science. And in fact, I was more and more sure I would have liked to do it in philosophy of biology. Mm-hmm. And that was even more difficult to find a place that would do that consistently. Most of the places at that point were in the States. And I wasn't really too keen to come into the States at that point. I mean, mostly really because it was very far away from quite a lot of my friends and family, and the structure of the programs was very, very different. And because I wasn't exposed to that culture before, I just thought it would be a very big commitment to suddenly commit to spend 6 to 8 years in the US, basically random.
Yeah.
You know, and so I was really primarily looking in Europe, and it just happened that at the same time, I was advised to apply to do a master's at the LSE in History and Philosophy of Science, because lots of people said, you know, actually doing a master's before may give you more grounding, which was absolutely true, in fact.
Right.
And ended up entering that program, and also getting a scholarship that would support my study in that program.
Nice.
And that sort of basically cemented that decision of then moving to the LSE and doing that.
Yeah.
So then I spent a year at the LSE. And in fact, there again, there was an issue about where I would do this PhD if I were to do it.
Right.
And LSE was very generous, and they offered me also a little scholarship and the possibility to continue in their program as a PhD student. So I did that. But in fact, it turned out during my first year of PhD that the fit wasn't perfect.
Oh.
Because, I wanted to do philosophy of biology. And at that point, they didn't have anybody in the faculty that was particularly interested in supervising that kind of approach.
They're more like philosophy of physics and philosophy of mathematics, things like that.
Yeah, and kind of decision theory, kind of some forms of political theory, but much more that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, ideally I could have worked with Nancy Cartwright, but she was away a lot of the year,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't actually end up being slotted with her. And so I wasn't entirely really sure that I should continue when I was in that program, because I was thinking this is really not entirely matching with what I really would like to do.
Sure.
Partly also because I've always been interested in doing philosophy of science with some empirical foundations.
Right.
So thinking about the history of science too, and thinking about what's actually happening in science. And that wasn't really an approach that was particularly congenial to the atmosphere at the LSE.
Sure.
And so, I regard it as luck that at that point in time, a position came up in Amsterdam that Azok Chang actually made me aware of. They were looking for a PhD student that would have been fully paid to do a PhD for 4 years on the notion of understanding. And in fact, they were looking for somebody that could do it in the realm of the biological sciences. And that was a dream come true. I mean, it was really perfect for me because it was a sort of broader subject. It would allow me to look at the practices of biology and at the same time do it within a cohesive philosophical framework.
Yeah.
And so I ended up going to Amsterdam for an interview with Henk Derecht and Hans Rudder that were heading the project, and ended up getting that position. And so I ended up moving from London to Amsterdam to do the PhD.
Wow. Yeah. So I'm very interested in this. I see this project you worked on in understanding scientific understanding, because scientists use the term understanding all the time. We are explaining this phenomena. By explaining this phenomena, we gain some kind of an understanding. We need an understanding. So perhaps could you describe a little bit about understanding in the scientific context and what some of your work led to in that regard?
Absolutely. So, I mean, the great thing about the project Understanding Scientific Understanding that was led by Henk Derecht at that point was that it started from the premise that within science, the acquisition of truth is an important goal, but it's not the only one.
Mm.
In fact, that a lot of scientists are motivated also sometimes more by the idea that what we're trying to do is to comprehend the world in better and better ways, whatever that better means, without necessarily relating that idea of better comprehension mm-hmm. to the acquisition of truth. That was an idea that for me was very interesting, because I'd been looking at some of the work on modeling, for instance, and the idea of actually, you know, famous idea of producing truer theories with false models,
mm-hmm.
for instance, or vice versa. And this idea that, in fact, producing knowledge about the world, it's something that we're doing also partly in order to try and interact with that world in a way that's more efficient, was something that, and more productive for us, was something that really appealed to me. And this was really part of the premise for the project. And so what we ended up doing is produce which was edited by Act and myself and the other PhD student in the project, Kai Agner.
Oh, do you mind repeating? I'm sorry.
We
cut out. Well, can you say that thing one more? What we just said one more time? I'm sorry. We just cut out a little bit.
I'm sorry about that. So we ended up producing a volume that mm-hmm. was called kind of Philosophical Perspectives on mm-hmm. Scientific Understanding, where we were looking at different problems relating to the notion of understanding. How can we clarify it in a philosophically cogent way? And in ways that actually contributes to the existing literature in philosophy of science. But also, how do we think about the differences between fields when it comes to acquiring this understanding?
Yeah.
So my work in biology, I deliberately focused on the manipulation of material models, because that seemed to me to involve a very, very important and interesting problem in philosophy, which is how do we relate embodied knowledge with knowledge. And what does that intersection mean for the process of research? How do we actually create knowledge which we regard as propositional, but in fact we do that through the acquisition of skills which are not propositional. They're just things that we can do with our body and ways.
Yeah, I was going to say, so embodied knowledge as opposed to factual, like kind of procedural knowledge kind of thing, or like, I'm trying to understand what I haven't heard that term, but I've heard.
Right. Okay. So no, I mean, so, you know, one of the classic loci to think about this is Gilbert Ryle. Mm-hmm. And his distinction between knowing how and knowing that.
Oh yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah, okay.
Being, you know, there is knowledge that we call propositional, which is the knowledge that can be encrypted, if you want, and in text or in symbols or in axioms and all different types, and knowledge that actually cannot really be codified in this way, but it's still a form of knowledge, which is the knowing how to do things.
Right.
It's typically performative. So the basic question in my PhD was to think about how these two forms of knowledge interact. And how do researchers utilize both propositional knowledge, kind of theoretical kind of perspectives, concepts, and embodied knowledge, so particular skills, ways of interacting with the world, to acquire understanding of particular phenomena. And so my emphasis, because I was working within biology and I really took it that one of the interesting things about biology as a science is the extent to which these material practices really underpin what is going on in the science and the knowledge that's produced, then I took that as a model for thinking more broadly about how does the manipulation of models generate knowledge? What kind of knowledge does it generate?
And
to which extent that understanding is actually localized? Because, of course, what you end up manipulating is always a very, very small part of reality, is a particular sample, one token of a particular type of organism, and you end up wanting to produce knowledge which is much broader than that. So the question was really, how do you acquire that broader understanding by interacting with models which are so standardized and so localized to suit particular needs?
Oh, geez. And so did you come to any interesting conclusions? Or?
Well, I mean, I hope. I gave a good account of, at least a preliminary account of how, I mean, basically I conceptualize understanding as a type of ability.
Okay.
So not as a result, but really as something that one learns through. And this is partly also following from Engdirect's framework. But in my particular case, I was focusing on the fact that in order to enact understanding, one needs unavoidably makes theoretical commitments. So you commit to exercising certain assumptions about what you think is true. But also one makes material commitments to the kind of samples you're going to be working with, the kind of materials you're going to be using to represent the world.
Yeah.
And also social commitments to the ways in communicate about your research and the ways in which you will interact with other researchers while you're doing your work. Mm-hmm. And so that provided a framework to think about understanding for me, but also it turned out to be the kind of intuition that actually underpins a lot of my work now. Because one of the things I was focusing on my PhD was the study of a particular case, which is the manipulation of one type of plant called Rhamnosus thaliana to produce knowledge about plant science. And what was interesting for me there is that this is a typical, is the most important model organism for plant science. That means that the vast majority of research in the plant science, certainly on the basic side, is actually done on this little plant.
Huh.
The big question was, how on earth does that even work? You know, how can you think about a whole field reaching such wide-ranging conclusions and understanding so much about the world, about the natural world, simply by working on a little plant, which is, you know, about maybe 5 to 10 centimeters tall, has no economic importance. It seems to be pretty irrelevant in any respect, but it still is the foundation materially for what we know.
Yeah.
And so the PhD examined that empirically at the same time as it did it philosophically. And that, I think, was really the foundation for me to do similar things with other topics, particularly the idea of data and evidence and how do we produce them.
This is a really fascinating topic. I'm very, very interested in this particular project and your understanding of understanding and how that changes, and your questions are very, very interesting that you're addressing. And yeah, I'm very interested to further along your work in plant science and data integration. I know that you're currently working on. So when you mentioned, you've said something about theoretical commitments, material commitments. Are commitments interchangeable with assumptions? Is that kind of the same? Would you say that's similar kinds of things? Or is there something further that a commitment gets us?
Yeah, I mean, that's a question that I'm still struggling with, actually. It's a very good question. I think I like the term commitment better because it puts an emphasis on the fact that whether or not an assumption one takes is deliberate, it has a very long-term effect on the ways in which, in the kind of knowledge that we're producing at the end. And also I like the idea of thinking about these assumptions as active elements of our knowledge production.
Right.
And things that, in fact, can change and do change as people do research and create all sorts of problems as they do. So, I think my thinking around what I used to call commitment in my PhD has shifted quite a bit.
Okay.
So when I ended up writing more about this in my further work, so which led to the book that came out then last year, I started to think more around, in fact, the meaning of classification.
Mm.
What does it mean for us to adopt some labels to describe things in the world?
Sure.
And what is the path dependency, in a sense, that the choice of those labels generates in terms of knowledge production? So, so that sort of started off for me as thinking about theoretical commitments, but it ended up going into an exploration of what we mean by classification in general as a practice, what people have said, of course, in philosophy about this. I mean, the natural kind discussion, of course, is one of the most famous that concerns this, but there's many philosophical traditions which have touched on that. And I ended up looking very much in detail at the ways in which people group data. In fact, they classify data as objects.
Right.
And that me quite a bit because very often people don't really look, I mean, at least in philosophy of science, people paid a lot, very little attention to the ways in which researchers actually classify the data other than thinking about the knowledge or the modeling they were doing. But it seemed to me that this was a very important decision to make in the first place, because particularly in a situation as we see now where we have data being distributed all over the place, particularly through databases, how you organize your data has a really important influence on how you will then find your data, search for them, and eventually select data that can act as knowledge, that can act as evidence for knowledge that you're interested in. And so I ended up through that work actually thinking about practices of classification, of labeling, and you could call them ways in which you acquire commitments, theoretically speaking, as a form of theory. So I ended up really arguing that what we have here is a form of theorizing that has been utterly underestimated in philosophy of science because, you know, it's not necessarily universalizing. But it does have a very, very important role to play in the acquisition of knowledge. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as my thinking has shifted. I think the idea is sort of there, but I've tried to get more and more precise about how to think about these things.
Yeah. Okay. So, great. So was this kind of the work? So after the PhD in Amsterdam, was this the kind of work that you were taking on in your postgraduate work?
I mean, I was that right after finishing my PhD, in fact, while I was still doing it, I got hired for a postdoctoral position in London again, bizarrely at LSE again, to work with Mary Morgan on this project called How Well Do Facts Travel?
Hmm.
It was an absolutely wonderful project that she had come up with a lot of funding from the Leverhulme Trust, which is a private foundation in the UK. And this was a generalist project, very interdisciplinary, bringing together people from lots of different fields that were thinking about how knowledge is actually circulated and disseminated and travels around through different contexts. And that was a very, very formative experience for me, partly because working with Mary Morgan is a wonderful experience. I'm sure everybody who has had that experience is also very grateful. Okay. But also because it really shifted a little bit the ways in which I was thinking about knowledge production in quite a profound way. So up to the point in which I arrived in London to do my postdoc, I had this idea anyhow that I was probably going to deepen the aspects of my previous work, my PhD, that concerned the production of evidence. Mm-hmm. And particularly data, because I got so interested and already wrote about this during my PhD in these practices of labeling data and making sure that, you know, the digital side of studying an organism would intersect with mm-hmm. the material practices used to manipulate an organism and how does that work and how does that give rise to understanding. So I had this idea that I would probably deepen questions around data production and data analysis. And as it turns out, trying to think about how data circulate mm-hmm. we in environments which go well beyond the sites where they've actually been produced became a really, I mean, it was perfect as a topic to investigate within this kind of how well do facts travel project.
Yeah,
but it also
yeah.
make me question some of the assumptions I've been making about thinking about knowledge generally in my work until that point.
Oh, okay. What kinds of assumptions were you, or what kinds of questions were you having?
Well, I mean, one of the big questions that comes from thinking about, you know, embodied knowledge, particularly in a lab, in biology, is the same set of considerations that underpins work by James Woodward and Jim Bogan on the distinction between it and phenomena, where they have this insistence that data are quintessentially local, that are such a idiosyncratic product of a very particular interaction between a researcher or a group of researchers and a very specific experimental setup, that it makes no sense to extract data from that environment because embodied knowledge involved is so important in then making sense of how that data can be interpreted. And in fact, I mean, I shared very similar intuitions. I'd given a lot of prominence to embodied knowledge in my own work. I was very sympathetic to this. Except for the fact that, of course, now looking at things like databases and the dissemination of data, even data about my favorite plant, Arabidopsis,
sure.
It was absolutely clear that a lot of researchers within certainly the plant sciences and beyond that were routinely using data that they were not involved in producing. Mm-hmm. So data really wasn't local in any realistic sense of the term. The world was full of data circulated. And of course, this was also... At the same time, this was about 2006, 2007.
Yeah.
So it was at a time where the whole discussion and the hype, if you want, about the fourth revolution, data tsunami, and all the rest of it started to become much more prominent, sure. both within research and also in the public sphere. And so I found myself in front of an interesting, for me, philosophical conundrum, which was, okay, so if I look at scientific practices and all these researchers are doing is reanalyzing, circulating, and reinterpreting data produced by others.
Yeah.
But so far, philosophy of science is only giving me tools to understand data as a quintessentially local, idiosyncratic research component. What's going on here? Of course, my response was to think, well, then maybe there's something wrong with philosophy, and maybe we need to do some work to think about how we can make philosophical sense of what we are now seeing.
Yeah.
In the sciences. And so that's really what gave rise to the work that I'm still doing now. It generated the essential question. So, you know, the postdoc was very important for me in regearing my thinking in that way.
Fantastic. So in an answer to how well do facts travel, would you say they travel okay? Or would you say, what would be, you know, I imagine you're still answering this question. Or you're still trying to figure it out. But I mean, at least, or people, you know, take it as they assume, they sometimes make assumptions that they do travel. But yeah, what are you finding?
So what I've really been interested in is looking at the conditions under which it's actually possible to make facts travel.
Right.
And in fact, you know, the shorthand we used in the project for my type of facts was small facts, because we immediately realized that, I mean, many of the facts as people typically understand them are in fact claims, which again come in the form of propositions, you know,
like, yeah.
you know, like these kinds of things. Humans cause climate change is the perfect fact that seems to travel or not, depending on the situation. While they tell something a bit different. They're not actually usually, they can be in propositional form, but they're not always so.
Sure.
And they have a slightly different relationship to the production of knowledge. So that's what I was really looking at. So, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of my work so far has been to really study the scientific practices which are associated to data production, dissemination, and reuse, and from those more empirical studies, extract in a sort of meta-empirical level, identify the conditions under which the data actually can travel and the conditions in which they don't, or they do, but then become very dubious objects to base your empirical knowledge on.
Yeah.
And then in turn, on that understanding, on that framework, to elaborate my own epistemology for what data are in the first place and
yeah.
how we should think about that. So, you know, so, I mean, so for instance, one of the things that I looked at specifically is the fact that one needs to really conceptualize the movement of data in two different stages. The first stage is to decontextualize the data. So quite a lot of work goes into, first of all, establishing what counts as data in the first place. I mean, what is going to travel here?
Yeah.
And this is not obvious in many research situations. Taken to be objects that are functioning as data. And what are all the information that actually should travel with those objects, which people typically refer to as metadata,
mm-hmm.
because otherwise we wouldn't be able to interpret them. But they're not data themselves. And of course, it's also a very difficult situation because you usually cannot really record everything that's happening while you're producing data. So a lot of interesting choices are happening in this process and in the process of decontextualization, which I talked about. And these are many of the practices also that we see characterize things like databases. It's exactly their function. I mean, they're choosing what do they display as data and also which information about those data they deem to be potentially relevant to people that then go and consult the database and try to reinterpret them. So the second stage of data travel
mm-hmm.
is the stage of recontextualization. And this is where people who are very often not the same people who actually produce the data go to a database, search for data that may be of relevance to them, look at the information available on
right.
the production's data, and then start to make their own inferences about what this data could mean and how they could be used as evidence. The importance of distinguishing between the two stages is exactly what explains the non-locality of data, I argue. So the beautiful thing about having somebody that recontextualizes data is precisely the fact that these people may not have the same expertise,
right.
the same interests, and the same goals as the people who produce the data in the first place. And that is actually what creates the epistemic productivity of that situation. I mean, now you have a situation where a pluralism of viewpoints
right.
is actually what generates the epistemic payoff. That's why you get new knowledge here, because these people look at the same data sets with different eyes, different abilities. They're familiar with different things in the world, and that can end up generating new interpretation. Of course, at the very same time, that is exactly the situation that brings you to all the problems that you also have with this.
So it's a virtue, a problem and a virtue in some way. Or it's
But that's the, you know, we usually the
yeah,
case.
Yeah, that's how things are.
Exactly. So the problem keeps being, you know, how is it even possible that people who are not that familiar with the data
yeah.
can use them credibly as evidence? But I think by starting to separate out these stages and really study how do you justify these different movements? How do you choose the metadata? Which them? I think we're getting a lot of understanding within philosophy about what it really means to produce evidence. And in fact, what it means in the first place.
Wow. So, wow, fascinating projects. So, where are you? So I guess maybe let's catch up with our timeline here. I'm kind of curious of where this project has been. So after the postdoc, what was next for you in terms of your first job or position, a faculty position?
Well, I was very lucky because at that point I managed to get a position at the University of Exeter, initially
great.
As a research fellow within what then was the ESRC Center for Genomics and Society, directed by John Dupre. And in fact, I'm still there.
Great. You're a young scholar. I realize this. This is great. So how's Exeter been?
Oh, it's been obviously great. I'm still there, and it's been a great experience for me, and really a great opportunity, because I was hired actually in a position that wasn't even clearly a philosophy position to start with. Uh-huh. So they were very happy for a philosopher, but in fact they were also interested in somebody that could write about some of the more sociological aspects of data circulation. Mm-hmm. But thankfully, my work more on also the empirical parts of data dissemination prepared me well for that, because I basically could produce every now and then a paper that was more sociological. It wasn't really my main interest, but it was for me a step towards being able to understand philosophically what was going on. So that worked out well. And also it gave me more research time than I would otherwise have had, because I had less to teach as part of that position, and I could devote a lot of time to research. And that basically paved the way for me to really acquire a lot of background and do more and more and more research on this issue of data dissemination. And then I ended up staying at Exeter. That thankfully was actually a tenure track position, uh-huh, which was confirmed. And then shortly after, 5 years or so after being at Exeter, I applied for an European Research Council grant, and I did get it ultimately on this issue about epistemology of data. And so, basically, it went on from there.
Okay. So, I guess, are there any other projects? It seems like you have a very, nicely coordinated and excellent program here, all related to data integration, study of data. Is there a particular study with which you'd like to share that is that we haven't discussed that either, or that is currently of kind of connected to your current work?
Well, I mean, there's quite a few things that we're doing right now, and of course, one of the nice things about doing it in Exeter is the fact that the department there is actually a department of philosophy, sociology, and anthropology together.
Oh,
and so the work that's going on there is there's quite a lot of philosophers of science.
Yeah,
in fact, there's more than 10 of us. But and that is extremely productive for the kind of work that I do, because that's exactly coming out of that intersection. So quite a lot of projects I've been involved in the last few years have been inspired by the opportunity to do that kind of work that was given in Exeter. So, I mean, most of the work I've done lately has been on the biomedical front and plant science front. So I suppose on the biomedical front, we've looked quite a lot at these issues around integrating data sets that come from very, very, very different sources.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of an extreme case of the problem I was discussing before. If within biology already you have a situation where people who have worked on two different kinds of the same organism may have difficulty understanding each other when it comes to exchanging materials. How on earth does one actually align and integrate data sets that come from completely different research traditions where people have different methods entirely and even looked at different things?
Yeah.
So one of the interesting projects that we looked at also with my postdoctoral fellow Nicolò Tempini, that's been working with me for the last 4 years or so, we looked at one of these so-called data mashups project, very popular, particularly in epidemiology, mm-hmm, where people try to bring together data that come from the medical sphere, so about individuals, about clinical studies, hospitals, with data that come from climate science, so both simulated data and also data about weather changes and forecasts, and data that are basically about the biology and the landscape, kind of environmental science, where people live. So the point of projects like this is, for instance, to be able to predict on the basis of information about which pathogens are around in a particular region, how do they behave on a seasonal level, and information about changes in the weather, where there could be outbreaks of a particular disease which is caused by those pathogens.
Yeah.
So that's interesting in terms of thinking about, for instance, the role of invariant assumptions in these kinds of big data alignments, and how do we justify that? Precisely, I mean, how do people strategically think about invariance exactly in this situation where it's so difficult to communicate across disciplines and make sense of each other's assumptions? Of course, I mean, thinking about biomedical data also brings in the direction of considering ethics as one of the important issues, which really conditions data access and use in a massive way. And so part of the work there has been to show that ethical considerations and considerations around the governance of data are in fact part and parcel of how technically we should think about data inference, in fact. So any of the questions that arise around the value of particular types of data analysis and the potential social implications of some kinds of data analysis really are questions that, of course, one can always ask before when one starts a project and at the very end of a project. But in fact, for the science to really reflect these questions and these concerns, they need to be asked during a research project and by the people who are actually really thinking through which data are we going to consider, why, how we do this, etc. And so really trying to show that issues like data fairness, for instance, this notion of fairness, which is so difficult philosophically.
I've heard of this,
Of thinking about how one thinks about the epistemology of data. And of course, I mean, all of this work, which I've done, I mean, similar work we've done in the plant sciences, I think shows, I mean, it sort of brought me more and more to think about the whole fact and value distinction.
Right.
And we in philosophy conceptualize that. Of course, there's a lot of work on this. It's also very actual at this point. It's very, you know, kind of, is a particularly controversial part of our work. But I think that's really one issue that some of my work currently on data can help to exemplify, the fact that really when you're looking at what people consider to be the foundations of empirical knowledge, you know, the givens of reality, the data, even there is basically impossible to separate out what counts as a fact and what is the value baggage that one brings to the interpretation of the data.
Oh, so you're taking away the one thing we could say, this is okay, this is objective, this is bad. No, I think everyone, I think you were right all along, but, you know, to suspect, you know, that it's tricky. So it sounds like you're doing two seemingly actually distinct kinds of, similar projects, but in different localities of plant science and the biomedical sciences. Are you finding that integration and or the way in which data are used or travel is different in these particular areas?
Yeah. it's a very good question. It's, of course, always very difficult to generalize in these situations. But broadly speaking, one of the reasons why I'm really interested in the plant sciences is that because it's, in a sense, a much smaller field scientifically than, you know, the ensemble of fields that cover biomedicine. And because, relatively speaking, they have access to much less funding. I mean, there's lots of historical reasons for this, but ultimately, plant scientists tend to be much more generalist than biomedical scientists, certainly the ones I'm working with.
Yeah.
And so within the plant sciences, there is, I think, regard for the broader implication of one's work, and also really a kind of more systematic thinking about what counts as an organism, why are we conceptualizing organisms in a certain way, how do we think about the intersection between genes and environment and physiology. So I would say the difference between work in the plant sciences and in the biomedical sciences is really a question of the scale of the enterprise and in many cases the incentives behind creating certain kinds of knowledge. So in biomedicine, you see an incredibly competitive situation where, you know, the vast majority of groups working towards something biomedical, which is seen to have a direct impact on humans. That's why they get funded. But it also creates a very competitive situation where lots of groups hyper-specialize on very particular directions of research, but also very particular ways of doing research, which become very well established. And in fact, that's some of the work also I've done with Richard Ankeny recently, in thinking about these units of research, these, what we call repertoires,
is very much
grounded on experiencing this sort of solidification of certain ways of doing research, which are not just conceptual, though of course there is a conceptual element, but also incorporate very different ways of doing things and getting funding and also advertising the research.
Right.
In the sciences, we see that too, but because partly the history of the discipline is what it is, and partly that kind of funding is just not available.
Yeah.
So people tend to be more generalists, Like they're more, you know, it's very difficult in the plant sciences, I would say, to find somebody who's working on genetics and doesn't have a very good understanding of evolutionary theory and developmental biology. That kind of division of labor is not quite as hyper-specialized as very often it becomes in biomedical realm. And so you get a situation where people are more willing to think outside of the box, have to be, in fact, more inventive in thinking about their research, and much more willing to think about questions which I would regard as philosophical. So, you know, how do we conceptualize an organism? What is the relationship between genes and environments? How do we set it up in the research that we're doing, etc.? So it's an interesting thing. Of course, in biomedicine, you will have other advantages, and you will be able to really think about what does it mean to do research in relation, for instance, to specific individuals. So how does that result relate to the particular group or the particular type of individual you're thinking about?
Yeah.
But certainly, I think that within the plant sciences, there is more openness. I mean, people are actually a little bit more able, I would say, or forced, maybe they would say, to think in terms, in more holistic terms, about what they're doing scientifically.
Wow, wow. So what do you, so this is a lot of current work. Do you have anything on the horizon? Any big new projects or wrapping up any other grants or things like that?
Well, I mean, right now I'm wrapping up a lot of things because I'm my main projects. And so at the moment I'm writing a book on the impact of big data on research.
Oh, great.
And I'm also writing a Stanford Encyclopedia entry on the same topic. So, I mean, hopefully this should be available by next year. And then at the same time, of course, particularly some of the cases I've considered as part of this work on data have raised quite a lot of questions for me around other issues or, you know, complementary issues in philosophy of science. And one of those is much more broadly the relationship between knowledge production and the characteristics of the research environment in which data are produced. So for instance, the things I've looked at with the work on plant science I've been doing in the last 3 years is the differences between lab-based science, which is, you know, typically what people really think about in philosophy of science very often, particularly within the biological sciences, and research which happens in these other spaces. Some of these spaces are the field trials, for instance, but also there's all these in-between spaces, like things like smart glass houses, which are glass houses which are partly automatized, so you can actually produce a huge number of research results and images, for instance, in phenomics, by sort of by processing plants in an automated way. These kinds of things. And also I've been interested in the differences between the different locations that I was really looking at. So as part of my work so far, I've looked at, of course, a lot of experience in working with very well-equipped labs in the States, in Europe, in Cambridge, in places like this.
Yeah.
But also I've started to experience what it means to work in places which maybe are not quite as well-equipped, or at the very least are in locations which are not quite as central to the scientific to scientific research. You know, from Wales to, I went to Nigeria for a while, kind of like, you know, like different places in India and things like that. And so I think one of the things that I'd be interested in exploring in future work, you know, in 2 or 3 years when some of the work can be to a close, is how does one conceptualize these kinds of issues? So again, going back to the idea of, you know, what are the conditions of scientific work, but also trying to approach some of the potential commitments we have made in philosophy of science about what we consider to be good scientific practice, and whether some of them actually are related to ideas we have around what is a good scientific environment, which maybe haven't really been questioned as much. You know, norms for good scientific practice, which I think at this point in time is a particularly big challenge.
No, I'm looking forward to hearing about this. So yeah, why don't we've covered a lot of ground. Why don't we conclude with the question I've been asking many of my guests, which is, what do you take to be the biggest challenge facing philosophers of science today?
So yeah, that's a great question, of course. I would say it would be great if philosophy of science could remain relevant, not just within philosophy as a broader field, but in fact as source of inspiration and dialogue with pretty much the rest of academia and beyond. And I'm saying this because, of course, I mean, I'm sure many other people in the show have said the same thing. We are living in a situation where maybe more than ever, particularly in kind of the more developed nations, mm-hmm. there is a questioning for the foundations of knowledge and what do we really mean by truth and
absolutely.
What are facts, alternative facts, who is to be trusted. And so I think it would be great if philosophy of science could be one of the main points for people to go to when thinking about these questions, because we have been thinking about these questions for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it's still the case, I believe, that the production of scientific knowledge is one of the greatest achievements of mankind. But that doesn't mean we should ever stop questioning why this is the case and where and when and how can it go wrong. So I think the big task for philosophy of science is to contribute as strongly as possible to public discussions of this kind. And that means, of course, on one end, doing more technical work within our field to understand these things in detail and with clarity and with rigor, but also taking the time to go out in the world beyond our community yeah. and be able to express these ideas in ways that people that are maybe not technical philosophers of science can still grapple with and give feedback on and actually interact with.
Excellent. Excellent. So yeah, it's a big challenge. Any potential, I guess, I don't know, like, is there something that you are doing or you've seen others do in relation to this challenge, you know, how to stay relevant, how to communicate, how to address these kinds of things? Like,
oh, it's a big question. I think many of us are trying in different ways. I mean, what I'm doing is actually right now, the book I'm writing is actually the first version of that book in any case is being yeah. written, first of all, in Italian, which is something I've never done before.
Oh.
And secondly, as a trade book. So not okay. as a fairly academic book. And part of that is that I just thought actually having a sort of in-between monograph, which explores some of these issues in ways that are not just technical for philosophers, but are hoping to reach a slightly wider audience would be a very good way for me to learn from those audiences and from this exercise and then kind of produce my broader monograph on these issues, which is more of an academic type.
Sure.
The other type of thing I've been doing quite a bit of in the last few years is take on political roles, or at least roles as advisor for governments in the ways in which they're thinking about, for instance, this whole issue about open science and open data, which is right. a very live discussion, particularly in Europe right now. So I've been working as the advisor on open science for the European Commission, which has actually taken a lot of my time.
Yeah, what, tell me a little bit. What has that experience been like?
Oh, it was, I mean, I have to say, it was very, very interesting for me. It was a huge learning curve, but it certainly taught me a lot about what part of the work that we're doing in philosophy of science can be of interest and relevance and significance to ongoing discussions really in science policy and the governance of science. So, I mean, as I would say, in fact, I'm going to give a keynote on this on the next SPSP, so that's sort of the final message of my keynote, is, I think it's very important for philosophers of science to ask themselves, so what?
Yeah.
What's the point about this work and for whom? But typically what I found is that identifying that so what, you cannot do on your own.
Mm.
Because what you have is your own point of view. So really identifying the so what really actually happens as an exercise of dialogue with other parts of society. So in my case, a lot of the so what messages I've identified in my own work have come through these interactions with different member states, different expert groups,
wow.
Science academies working both at a global level internationally and at the level of each individual country, particularly in Europe, because it's through these interactions, which really were all about, you know, what do we value in knowledge production? How do we think, what do we think knowledge is? What do we think research should be? And what are the right and the wrong ways to do it, to perform it? And
yeah.
these discussions really are very philosophical, but of course, how somebody in policy would think about them and the kind of answers they're seeking are very, very different from the ones that we are normally, used to think about.
Right.
So for me, it was very, very interesting to have a very strong push, in fact, to try and translate some of the ideas that I'm developing philosophically into lessons that can actually be of interest to people who are, in fact, managing huge data sets, who are managing big infrastructures, and who are thinking about what kind of legal framework to adopt for these kinds of exercises. So that's sort of exactly what I ended up doing.
Fantastic. And in the same way that, you know, issues of in terms of facts traveling and things like that, do you think that is there anything that is lost, or is anything, is there a difficulty in translating like the rich philosophical lessons that you've come up to these lessons in relation to policy and the way, you know, like, do, you know, sort of, do we lose something or gain something potentially by doing this?
Oh, both. Of course, an academic will always be frustrated.
Yeah, you're right. Yes, that's,
of course, nobody really wants to hear about the philosophical sophistication of my framework. By the same token, I think, first of all, a lot of philosophers, I think, underestimate the extent to which some ideas can really be simplified and presented in a way that goes still to their core.
Yeah.
But it's actually intelligible to people outside of the field. I think that's a skill, that really is a skill. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. It requires a lot of rigor and, in fact, a lot of clarity in your thinking to be able to communicate in that way.
Yeah.
And for me, certainly I gained a lot, I think, in my philosophy from the constant questioning and constant exercise in trying to explain some of these ideas in ways that were really not helped by our usual network of references and citations and technical jargon. At the very same time, I think it also provides you with a very, at least for me, it was a very, very important ways, the real expert on some of the stuff that I'm working on. So, I mean, to me, certainly as a philosopher, of course, I can have a very strong, in fact, I have a very strong normative framework in the things I do.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think the destiny of philosophers of science is of being philosophers of something. And you can have all sorts of different ways of conceptualizing what that something science is, but ultimately you're condemned, for better or worse, to be in dialogue with something outside of yourself. So having ways of testing and really getting feedback from what that outside thing is, from people who are absolutely the top of their field in what they do, and they're recognized international experts on a very regular basis, has been really, really important for me, because I think it gave me a lot of confidence that what I was trying to do and I'm still trying to do in my work is, in, to some extent, from a certain perspective, that reflects some of the things that are actually happening out there.
Wow. That's great. That's great. Well, Dr. Sabina Leonelli, thank you so much for hanging out, getting to chat. It's been fantastic to hear your story. Yours is one of an early mid career that is already you know, so strong and so carrying on. So I'm really excited to see your current work, your new book that is I guess out in maybe next year, something like that.
Hopefully,
great. Is there anything else you'd like to share or to plug? Anything to announcements or anything like that before we go?
Oh, I think it's just great if people, you know, kind of are aware of SPSP as a general initiative, because there's lots of people who actually you have interviewed, so you're very aware of that. But other philosophers who are interested in trying to understand what it means to think about scientific practice and how that may affect their work. And so if people are not really aware of that, there's a very nice website that's out there that explains some of this work, and of course they're very much invited to the next editions of those conferences.
Absolutely.
But other than that, I would thank you. It was a very, very interesting interview. Lots of very nice questions.
Of course. Actually, I have one last question. So in terms of the practice oriented, is there like perhaps like sort of an exemplar paper or sort of book detailing kind of the move for philosophy of science in practice, kind of explaining to those, hey, this is how philosophy of science has been done, and now it is very practice oriented, but something, I don't know, have you come across any work like that?
Yeah, so it's difficult. I don't think there's really a textbook in that sense, partly because it ends up being, you know, finding a method to do philosophy of science in practice, I think, becomes rather idiosyncratic to the kind of questions you're asking, the field you're in, you know, that kind of thing. However, I mean, certainly there are a few editorials written over the years by people that were involved in the steering committee of SPSP, or the Society for the Philosophy of Science in Practice. Which actually are editorials to special issues that came out of the earlier editions of the conferences. So these are worth having a look at because they will kind of start to examine in more detail what does it mean to do work in this way. There's a nice volume edited by Hannah Anderson and Nancy Nersensian, among others, which looks at this idea of empirical philosophy of science and starts to have a deeper look at some of the methods used. I think many of us have been, I have a methodological paper looking at what does it mean to do this for bioinformatics. I'm sure other people who are involved in SPSP have also their own specific papers looking at least some examples of why does one bother and what does one gain from doing philosophy in this way. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good question. We're still looking for people who actually reflect more on this, also from a methodological point of view.
Sure, it's kind of like meta philosophy of science or something. But I'm just curious of, you know, I've been fascinated by this. I've been trained in more of a practice oriented approach, and it's been great to see a conference that's been, you know, so is widely attended and seems to be, you know, will be at the PSA this year, I think. I'm just interested if there's any sort of current thoughts or editorials about it. Seems like there are, though.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, if one goes to the SPSP website, you will find some links. And but I mean, it is true that we should really think about trying to put together a textbook or some sort or any artist, a compendium of reflections on this.
Sure, sure.
There are lots of workshops happening on this, but of course, it would be good to have something written.
Right, right. All right. Well, Sabina, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.